supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia is one of the few places in Pennsylvania that limits the size of contributions to political campaigns. But U.S. Supreme Court decisions make it possible for independent groups to write big checks and spend as much as they want to influence city elections. WHYY's Dave Davies has been looking at the numbers. He reports that more than half the $5 million spent on the Philadelphia District Attorney's race was raised outside the city's contribution limits.
The exuberant crowd at winning candidate Larry Krasner's victory party could just as easily have been chanting, "Soros, Soros." Billionaire George Soros dropped $1.4 million into an independent campaign to support Krasner. That check alone was more than a quarter of the $5.3 million spent by all seven Democrats in the DA's race. When you add in spending by a labor-funded super PAC for another candidate and the cash well-off candidates put into their own war chests, 59% of the money spent in the race was raised outside city contribution limits, according to a WHYY analysis. Mayor Jim Kenney says that's the post-Citizens United world.
It's federal law, and it applies to everybody, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, it is what it is. Until the Supreme Court does something different, it's going to be this way.
Joe Kahn was the first candidate in the race. He made calls every day and managed to raise more than $700,000 within the city's limits, only to see the Soros money change the campaign.
I thought it was disturbing that, you know, a Philadelphia election could be so heavily influenced by outside groups unconnected to the candidates themselves.
While there was independent spending in this campaign and the last mayor's race, much has come from sources like Soros with an ideological agenda rather than an interest in city contracts or favors. City Ethics Board Director Shane Creamer says the system isn't perfect, but he thinks the city's rules have improved things.
These groups can come in, they can spend money. I think there have been mixed results. But you have to keep in mind also that if we didn't have the contribution limits, these groups could contribute unlimited amounts directly to the campaigns.
Since outside groups started spending in city races, the Ethics Board has imposed tougher reporting requirements. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
A newly released Brookings Institution report is entitled Connect to Compete, How the University City, Center City Innovation District Can Help Philadelphia Excel Globally and Serve Locally. Joining me to make sense of the report is Jennifer Vey. She managed the team that wrote the report. And Bruce Katz, co-author of The Rise of Innovation Districts, also co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution. Jennifer, Bruce, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I understand you presented this report to the Chamber of Commerce today. How was it received?
We think it was received pretty well. We've been working with these folks for a long time during the duration of our study and, you know, really came up with something that we think really reflected what's happening in Philadelphia and also what we think are a very actionable set of recommendations.
What does Philadelphia do right?
Philadelphia has incredible assets in the advanced economy, and they all tend to be co-located and concentrated in a very, very small geography, like many other cities around the United States and the world.
So in Philly, we're talking about a 1.5 square mile district.
Exactly. So it's the university city district that jumps over the river into West Center City, where the new Comcast location is located.
So right around 17th Street.
Absolutely. So because of large amounts of federal research dollars, particularly around life sciences, biosciences, you have become a platform for the next innovation in healthcare. You're one of really five or seven cities in the United States and the world that can be the go-to place for that super sector of the economy. You also, because of the Navy Yard, because of Drexel, have some real chops, so to speak, around advanced energy, advanced manufacturing, advanced materials. I mean, this is a very large metro, but its innovative platform because of where your research universities are, where your hospitals are, where the University City Science Center sits, is very, very small. The city's 141 square miles, and the metro is multitudes of that, and we're talking about 1.5 square miles. That's the platform for your innovative economy.
on what metrics do we lag?
Well, what we found is, how do you take basic science research and move it to commercialization? How do you create companies? How do you create products? Because what Philadelphia needs, like any American city needs, more jobs, quality jobs, more tax revenue. So you've got to basically grow an innovative and inclusive economy that's fiscally robust from the ground up.
Another thing that we really discuss in our report is the fact that you've got this innovation district that's located right within some very high poverty neighborhoods in West Philadelphia. And clearly, if you want to have more inclusive economic growth, you need to be sure that the growth that's happening in this geography is redounding to the benefit of more people.
To date, what report card would you give University of Pennsylvania and Drexel regarding being good community partners?
I think they've been making valiant efforts over a number of years. And they, you know, Penn and Drexel and the Science Center have numerous initiatives, you know, STEM-based initiatives to, you know, engage students in science and technology and math occupations. They, you know, have various types of community engagement initiatives, business development initiatives, procurement initiatives in terms of looking at their own buying power and how that can help fuel business development by buying local. So there's a lot going on. And what we really call for is, how do you take a lot of these existing efforts and better align them, coordinate them, and scale what's working?
Your starting base is as good as it gets, frankly. Your physical geography is phenomenal. But to really get to the next stage of growth and put yourself on the global map, you're going to have to sort of put collaboration on steroids and market and brand with much more precision what you're good at and why the rest of the world needs to care. There's only a dozen places in the world that even have what's necessary to compete. The research institutions, the ecosystem of companies.
Philadelphia's in that cohort.
You're definitely in the cohort. You could be one of the top three globally.
Jennifer Bruce, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Happy to be here.
Jennifer Vey manages a team that has put out the report based on an 18-month study from the Brookings Institution entitled Connect to Compete, How the University City, Center City Innovation District Can Help Philadelphia Excel Globally and Serve Locally. Also, Bruce Katz, co-author of the report entitled The Rise of Innovation Districts, also co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Today, the blue and red Haitian flag flew over Philadelphia City Hall in honor of that country's Independence Day. But the celebration was overshadowed by a looming deadline that could affect more than 58,000 Haitians across the country. Steve Paul is a Haitian-American who works in Councilwoman Helen Gim's office.
They are scared that they might lose the protection from deportation and sit back to a country that is still trying to recover from the earthquake.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff offers this story on why the possible end to a kind of temporary immigration status for Haitians has many in that community worried.
On Saturday, pastors gathered in a storefront Haitian church in Northwest Philadelphia and asked God to bless a group that's more often the butt of jokes.
We thank God for our attorneys that are here this morning.
Flanked by flat-screen TVs and bouquets of plastic flowers, three immigration attorneys sat at a folding table in front of the altar. Attorney Ayodele Gonzalo is with the refugee support group HIAS. She lays out the backstory for what's called temporary protected status to the 30 or so Haitians sitting in the pews.
We know that shortly after the earthquake, the government did the right thing and gave Haitians in the United States temporary protected status.
Temporary protected status, or TPS, is granted to immigrants from countries in extreme but temporary circumstances, usually a natural disaster or civil war. In 2010, an earthquake near the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince killed 250,000 people. In the aftermath, UN peacekeepers introduced cholera, a waterborne disease that killed thousands more. By granting TPS, U.S. officials gave Haitians living in the U.S. a temporary pass to stay and work here, says Gonzalo.
As a result of TPS, Haitians in the United States were able to come out of the shadows to get work authorization, to be able to support themselves and their family members both here and in Haiti.
In a letter written this April, James McCammett, who heads up the Office of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, recommended ending the status for Haitians. McCammett says Haiti has made, quote, significant progress since the earthquake, but he acknowledges ongoing problems. Those include food shortages and weak infrastructure, worsened by Hurricane Matthew, which struck the island's southwest coast last fall. His recommendation has rocked people shielded by the temporary status.
It's just not knowing of what's going to happen. It scares me.
This young woman doesn't want her real name used because after living in the U.S. for nearly 25 years, almost no one in her life knows her real story. Her mom brought her from Haiti as a child, and before 2010, she didn't have papers. With TPS, she was able to get a driver's license and a professional job in Center City. Now, there's a real possibility she'll lose that life and return to a country she barely knows.
You know, this is my life. I became an American, you know, so you're sending me back to what?
If it's not renewed, people with TPS have three options. Return to Haiti, stay in the U.S. illegally and face deportation, or apply for another kind of immigration benefit if they're eligible. Back at First Haitian Church of God in Northwest Philly, Pastor Nestle Nozel has a different take. He's not affected by TPS, but is optimistic for people he knows are worried.
We believe that something is going to happen in favor of the Haitian people, because especially President Trump, he's a believer. I know he's a man of good heart.
During his campaign, President Donald Trump courted the Haitian vote in places like South Florida's Little Haiti, engendering goodwill. Ultimately, it's up to Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly to make the call by next Tuesday's deadline. DHS declined to comment on the letter from McCammett and said the department is still, quote, assessing circumstances in Haiti. In the meantime, Haitian Independence Day served as a rallying cry, a chance for Haitian immigrants to stand up and plead for those afraid of being sent away. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Many immigrant groups feel uneasy under the weight of President Donald Trump's calls for closed borders and deportations. This week, we've been hearing stories from immigrants living in our region without legal status. We're calling it life unauthorized.
He told me I was supposed to come back to Mexico.
I feel sad, angry, and not cheerful.
Back at home, I would be in danger.
I agree with what Donald Trump has been doing about getting all the criminals out.
I'm just trying to stay on the right path.
The restaurant industry is one of the biggest employers of immigrants, and research shows that whether they're here legally or not, those cooks, cashiers, and servers tend to work off the clock without pay far more than U.S.-born workers. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo has this story of a woman from Jamaica who came here for a better life but fell into the wage gap trap that snares so many immigrant workers.
Tanisha says she tried for 10 years to come to the United States to get away from poverty and unemployment in her island country and later a bad marriage. She finally got a visitor's visa in 2015, but Tanisha says she went from an abusive spouse to an abusive employer.
I was working like over 12 hours a day for $300 a week, and that's like 6 days per week. Cooking, serving, cashing, cleaning, everything. I felt real used and abused. They told me I have to keep a low key because they know people. They know people in immigration. They know police officers. They know lawyers. People treat immigrants here like criminals and slaves. And that's just a fact. Overall, they work you for little or nothing. They take advantages. And some people really treat you like dirt.
Tanisha's visa was good for 6 months, but she says she missed a deadline to renew it after some bad advice from her employer. So she became one of the 11 million immigrants living in the U.S. without papers. She eventually left her bad job and now works as a home health care aide. Her 4 children still live in Jamaica with relatives, and she sends money home as often as she can.
The economy is real bad in Jamaica. So I came here to see if I could make a better life for me and my kids, really. That's the bottom line.
That bottom line hasn't persuaded authorities to let her stay legally. The immigration attorneys Tanisha has consulted tell her that her best path to citizenship at this point is to find an American man to marry. That's not something she intends to do. Instead, she pays taxes and does whatever she can to keep off immigration authorities' radar.
I'm just trying to stay on the right path because I can understand to a point if you want to get out the immigrants that have bad records, violence and murderers and stuff. I can understand that. But what about us that are innocent? Why are you aiming at us? We're just trying to make an innocent living here, an honest living in helping not just your country, but our country also and our family.
Tanisha dreams she'll someday bring her children to live here. Her youngest is just 4. She hasn't seen them since she left Jamaica.
Nearly 2 years. I talk to them on the phone, FaceTime, but not being able to physically see them or in touch with them.
Unless she fixes her own immigration issues, FaceTime and phone calls are all she'll get.
That was WHYY's Dana DeFilippo speaking with a woman from Jamaica for our series, Life Unauthorized. To hear more about the practical challenges unauthorized immigrants in our region face, visit newsworks.org/lifeunauthorized.
It's time to recognize that we've come to a turning point. We're threatened with an economic calamity of tremendous proportions, and the old business-as-usual treatment can't save us. Together, we must chart a different course.
That's President Ronald Reagan in 1982 taking stock of the nation. That's also the scene that opens the movie Billboard Boys. The movie is being shown tonight in Ambler and again Sunday in Phoenixville. Joining me is the film director, Pat Taggart. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, although President Reagan wasn't specifically referring to Allentown, that's ground zero for this movie. How did you choose this topic?
So it was Christmas about 3 years ago, and my family is from the Lehigh Valley, my wife's family. So there's a 30-year retrospective article that had come out right around Christmas time. And I saw my mother-in-law and my father-in-law in the corner giggling about something. And anytime you see two senior citizens giggling about something, I'm in. So I walk over and I say, hey, what are you talking about? And they hand me this article, and I was just taken by this story. And my first thought was, someone had to have done something in the 30 years since then on this. I mean, it had to. It's too perfect a story, and no one had.
Well, the Wall Street Journal did, and People Magazine did, and Phil Donahue and Rolling Stone, but it wasn't shown visually like this depiction. Now tell us about the story. Who were the Billboard Boys?
Absolutely. So the year is 1982. The economy is terrible, as we just learned from President Reagan. Interest rates on homes are 18%.
Unemployment's high.
Oh, through the roof.
Bethlehem Steel had just closed down a lot of their facility.
Mack trucks have gone. So this particular area, while the whole United States was really struggling, this area was just taking a beat down. And so this radio station said, hey, what if we play off of this, put 3 guys up on a billboard, and say whoever stays the longest wins an $18,000 mobile home? They thought maybe 30 days they'd hang. They got a lot more than they bargained for.
How many days in total?
261.
But these guys were playing by the rules. They wanted to be in, but they couldn't afford a home in their town, Allentown. And so they resorted to this. It kind of harkens back, as the movie describes, to a previous era, the Depression, where there were things like marathon dances or sitting atop a flagpole. Same kind of a contest.
Yes. And you know, none of them thought it would be very stiff competition. I mean, the thing is that all 3 of these guys were ideally suited to stay up there forever if they had to. They just didn't think they'd be paired up with 2 other guys were as capable as them. One guy says that, you know, hey, I expected, you know, a high school kid and a middle-aged housewife, not the stereotype. That was his stereotype. What they got was something entirely different. They got up there and they realized, oh my goodness, like, I'm in trouble.
Wall Street Journal, that really got it accelerated.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal was really the ticking point for this. So it's going along. It's still a fairly local contest. A rookie reporter from the Wall Street Journal drives through the Lehigh Valley, learns about this contest. It's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Literally overnight, the entire world knew about it. And the crazy thing was, this was before the internet. You know, this is really before cable television. So really, news was basically still local at that time. It was hard for anything to go viral. This thing went viral overnight, amazingly.
Before they knew the term going viral.
Yes.
As it was a music station, there was a musician who inadvertently helped. His name was Billy Joel. His song was called Allentown, and that came out 2 months into the experiment.
Dave, very serendipitously, 2 months into the contest, Allentown comes out, and it becomes basically the soundtrack for this contest. Though we like to point out that Allentown spent less time on the Billboard Top 40 than the Billboard contest lasted.
But in the broader sense, there are parallels to be made between that time and that place and the millions in America now who, again, play by the rules and don't see themselves reaping the reward.
Absolutely. You know, and these guys set out for a very simple goal. And at one time, it was considered a birthright in the States to be a homeowner. And, you know, this film very much mirrors today, where that can't be taken for granted anymore. It's still a tremendous privilege, and it's a privilege that is enjoyed by a minority, not the majority.
And as you open with Ronald Reagan, the story closes with another quote from the president. Let's hear.
My friends, we did it. We weren't just marking time. We made a difference. All in all, not bad. Not bad at all.
A wonderful product, a wonderful watch. Best of everything to you in this and subsequent endeavors.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Director Pat Taggart, Billboard Boys, screening tonight in Ambler and again Sunday in Phoenixville. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.